Radio 4 presents the Mark Steele Lecture, a series of lectures on people with a passion. Tonight, Napoleon Bonaparte. Traditionally, the life of Napoleon is a tale of a short Corsican who bullied his way to the head of an empire. But much of this depends on what you mean by words such as short or empire. He was 5'6½", short now, but at the time, this was the average height of Frenchmen. So how can he have had a Napoleonic complex then? Did he think, I'm fed up of being smaller than people who live 200 years from now? Napoleon's empire was hailed at the time as a beacon of liberty. In 1789, the French Revolution began and the royal family were forced to leave their palace. And yet the strange thing is, you can almost respect a fervent royalist from those times. Because for them, royalism was an order from God. It was a method of rule. It wasn't just a series of commemorative plates. Whereas now, people justify royalty with arguments like,
well, they bring in a lot of tourists.
Because you never get any tourists in France or Ireland or America, do you? You look out from the top of the Eiffel Tower and you think, it's not a bad view, but, I don't know, the lack of a monarch seems to spoil it somehow. Rules that at one point had some purpose, now just mad. Like, it is against the rules for a monarch to marry a Catholic. Were they afraid that if they relaxed that rule, the Queen would run off with Martin McGuinness? As long as the Queen Mother died and you've got people like Norman St. John Stevens going, oh, we'd never have won the war without her, you know. She was mother. She used to fly Spitfires at night. She did. The RAF tried to stop her, but she wouldn't have it. She was that sort of woman. I never forget one day she was shot down over enemy lines, landed in occupied France. You know, she still made it back the next morning for the changing of the guard. This is true now. I was in High Wycombe during the week that the Queen Mother died, and the local paper actually said,
as many locals know, she had a keen fondness for Buckinghamshire as she visited Aylesbury in 1938.
Napoleon was born in Corsica, which was ruled at the time by Genoa, and his family were small landowners and leading supporters of the battle for Corsican independence. Now, the Genoese were driven out of Corsica, but they sold the whole island to France. In 1778, Napoleon was sent to a French military academy as one of the only state-subsidised boys in a school full of children from the nobility. Now, at this point, Napoleon's ambition was to become a writer, and you can't help thinking, some people who want to become writers or artists, like Napoleon or Hitler, should really just be allowed to get on with it, shouldn't they? Or put it another way, imagine the damage that Frederick Forsyth might have done if he'd taken up something that mattered. We'd all be living in a post-nuclear heap of rubble going, apparently he wanted to be a writer. Napoleon also played a leading role in the most crucial battle of the revolution at the Tuileries Palace. After the battle, the royal family were jailed and then eventually executed. Now, Napoleon joined the most radical group, the Jacobins, and he returned to Corsica to defend supporters of the revolution against royalists. And the revolutionary leader, Danton, said,
the kings of Europe threaten us. We hurl at their feet the head of a king.
And the armies of Europe responded by intensifying the war against the revolution. Now, Napoleon was sent off to a place called Toulon in the south of France to fight off a royalist army that was backed by the British. And he was wounded by a pike. And a surgeon stood over him about to saw his leg off, but Napoleon insisted that the surgeon should have another look first, at which point the surgeon said, oh, yes, it doesn't need to come off after all. Well, they don't change, do they, the medical profession? Eventually, the Jacobins themselves were overthrown, and Napoleon, like many of their most prominent supporters, was jailed. The new regime wanted a republic, but with less involvement from the mass of citizens, and they called themselves the Directory. But they needed commanders like Napoleon, so he was released after 2 weeks, and they were especially dependent on Napoleon when the royalists staged an uprising to try and make the Count d'Artois the new king. And so Napoleon agreed to lead the assault on the royalists, which he did successfully, and he became a national hero. So imagine that, a country where you become a hero for defeating royalists.
In this seemingly never-ending queue here is Martha Dibworth from Doncaster. What made you come here today?
I saved up me pension and come down on coach, and I've been in queue to fire cannon at Windsor Castle for 21 hours. But it's worth it, because they're bastards.
Right after the battle, he went missing for 2 hours, and he wouldn't say where he'd been. Now, the rumour was that army chiefs had found him in bed with a blonde called Suzanne. But isn't that a bit too James Bond to be true? Maybe he pulled down the blinds, fought off one last royalist with a metal claw, and then said,
"Now to attend to another little uprising."
As Napoleon awaited his next mission, he met a woman called Rose Beauharnais. Now, she was the daughter of a plantation owner, and she'd had affairs with a variety of generals. She was the Edwina Curry of the Directory. Now, Napoleon was instantly besotted with Rose, who he thought should be called Josephine. He wrote a letter to a friend saying,
"Elle a la petite, she has the sweetest little in all of France. It's like the three islets of Martinique."
Now, I have to confess, I'm not entirely sure what he means here, but he was clearly very much in love. I'll tell you what, though, it makes you want to go and get a map of Martinique, doesn't it? They had a civil marriage, but on their wedding night, Josephine's dog bit Napoleon's leg. And throughout this time, Josephine was seeing another general and complained to her friends that Napoleon was useless in bed. Despite this, Napoleon was made commander of the campaign against Italy, which was seen as a defence of the revolution by turning the Italian states into republics. The one problem with Napoleon's campaign in Italy was he became desperate to see Josephine. From Milan, he wrote,
"You are going to come, aren't you? You're going to be here, beside me, in my heart, kissing my heart."
But she didn't write back. Mostly because she was spending her time with a 5'2" lieutenant called Hippolyte Charles, who she said was
a far better lover than Napoleon.
But it was quite a test she was set in, to be such a great lover you can stay unfazed while being attacked by a wild hound. Must have been like being in a pornographic version of It's a Knockout. By now she wasn't even opening the letters, and he became so distraught that he announced to the government,
"I am in despair. My wife must be detained by some lover in Paris."
The leaders of the Republic became worried that Napoleon was about to abandon his army, so they tried to persuade Josephine to visit her husband, and in the end she only agreed if she could travel with Hippolyte Charles and the dog, and the journey could be made to last 18 days. By the end of the campaign, republics had been set up throughout Italy, and one of the leaders of the Directory said of Napoleon,
"Everyone regards him as a genius. He is feared, loved, and respected in Italy."
When Napoleon got back to Paris, he kept Josephine happy by building a menagerie for her animals, but then he spoiled everything by celebrating when the dog that had bitten him was killed in a fight with the cook's dog. Josephine banished the cook's dog from their grounds, but Napoleon readmitted it, saying,
"Perhaps it will rid me of her new dog, too."
But now I'm going to do what most people would think is probably impossible and make you feel sorry, I think, for Napoleon. Because Napoleon's next expedition was to Egypt, and just as Napoleon was about to launch the Battle of the Nile against the British Navy, his friend Junot told him what almost everyone else in France already knew, that Josephine was spending every available moment with Hippolyte Charles. Now, you might think that finding your wife's having an affair with a bloke called Hippolyte is as big a blow as your ego could take. But it got worse, because Napoleon wrote letters to friends and to Josephine, spilling all his torment at this news, except that the ship carrying the letters was intercepted by the British Navy, who then read them and published them in the next day's Morning Chronicle. Could anything be more humiliating? Maybe like if the Daily Mirror 3am girls photographed Saddam Hussein's wife in the Groucho Club snogging Jamie Theakston. To gain control of Egypt, he had to do a deal with the leaders of the mosques, and their first demand was that Napoleon and his army should all convert to Islam, give up alcohol, and be circumcised. That'd test your revolutionary spirit, wouldn't it? Now, Napoleon didn't accept the demands, but he did fall in love with Egypt, and he said,
"I saw myself founding a new religion, riding an elephant, and in my hand, a new Quran that I had composed to suit my needs."
And presumably the rewritten version would have been stuff like,
"And God said that every year on that day, a grapefruit would be shoved up the arse of all men called Hippolyte."
While in Egypt, Napoleon was called back to France. The economy had collapsed, there were widespread shortages, the five leaders of the Directory were involved in corruption scandals, and the Jacobins were becoming popular again. Now, a group planned a military coup in which Napoleon would be a major player. Now, Napoleon and his brother Lucien started the coup by surrounding the Directory Parliament. Napoleon marched in and announced that he was ending the chaos of the country by taking power. The directory didn't put up much of a fight, with most of them jumping out of the window and running off. So Napoleon was now the new ruler of France. But in some ways, this seemed to make his domestic situation even worse. In his first year as leader, Josephine bought 900 dresses and 1,000 pairs of gloves. Then Napoleon started going out with an actress. Everyone in Paris, apart from Josephine, seemed to know about this, until one night Napoleon was with the actress in his residence at St. Cloud, while Josephine was in the grounds. Now, suddenly, the actress let out a scream that was so piercing it could be heard all over the building. So Josephine and the valets rushed up to the room and found Napoleon lying on the floor, having had an epileptic seizure, while the actress was stood naked by the bed yelling because she thought that he was dead. That's just what you want when you've had an epileptic seizure, isn't it? Your wife bursted in to find a yelling, naked actress. While you're laying there, barely able to move or speak, going, I know this looks bad. Now, from here on, his behaviour became increasingly like that of the monarch that he deposed. He held a referendum to make him leader of France for life. And one soldier wrote in his memoirs,
we were summoned by our general, who said, you are free to hold your own opinion. Nevertheless, I warn you that the first man not to vote for Napoleon as leader for life will be shot.
And you know, the marvellous thing is there could be a rule like that now about having to vote Conservative or be shot, and there'd still only be a 2% swing. Napoleon moved into the old Royal Tuileries Palace. He ordered that coins should have his picture on. And so the royalists still hated him. One royalist group hid a barrel of gunpowder in a cart that was timed to explode when Napoleon went past in his carriage. But that day, Napoleon's driver was drunk, and so he went much faster than normal. So the bomb missed him and maimed 52 bystanders instead. Maybe this was a tip that got passed on through the centuries. When you're driving a historical icon through Paris, always make sure you're over the limit. Despite all this, around the world, Napoleon was still a hero to radicals. Radical groups that were hoping to copy the revolution grew all around the world, and they saw Napoleon as the leader of this hope, partly because he was winning. So they turned a blind eye to his bad points. For example, that he appeared to be going completely mad. He became convinced that no project could start on a Friday. He developed a fear of open doors, which must have been one of the most inconvenient phobias there is. But mostly, he took his advice from a little red genie. He said that he'd made a 10-year pact with the genie just before a battle in Egypt, in which the spirit would protect him as long as he brought in a universal republic. If Napoleon reneged, the genie would give him 3 formal warnings and then abandon him to his enemies. Now, there was a certain amount of disillusion when Napoleon began to reintroduce the Catholic Church into the government. He did a deal where the state would pay for the church's upkeep as long as he could appoint the bishops. Now, this would be fine if you were doing it just for a laugh. Archbishop of York, Phil Mitchell.
And Jesus said unto the devil, get thee behind me, Satan. We've got to talk.
But Napoleon was lucid in his reasoning. He wrote,
how can a state be well governed without the aid of religion? When a man dies of hunger next to another who is gorged, he cannot accept that disparity without some authority saying, God has decreed there must be rich and poor, but in the afterlife for eternity it will be the other way about.
But all Napoleon's actions were leading to an event that did shatter millions of his Republican followers when he made himself emperor. He would be officially crowned, and his offspring would automatically succeed him, although he had even more authority than your average king, because he declared that his brothers couldn't take their place in line to the throne unless they left their wives, who he didn't like. Which, as sellouts go, is pretty bad. And Napoleon went for all this in a big way. The coronation was in the Notre Dame. He wore a velvet coat embroidered with golden bees. He wore a hat covered in diamonds. Josephine wore a diamond tiara. And Napoleon was anointed by the Pope. But mostly, radicals everywhere were gutted, including, most famously, Byron and Beethoven. And it must have seemed not only like a betrayal, but an unstoppable one, as Napoleon now appeared invincible. Worse than with Thatcher in the early 80s. The only thing I remember about that time that really perked you up was the really old people. You'd be stood in a shopping centre giving out leaflets, and these people about 80 had come past and go, what's that? Kick her out! You don't want to kick her out! You want to slowly strip off her skin, cover her in marmalade!
shove her in a hive of wasps. Never mind kicking her out. You want to stick needles in mercury and jab them on her nerve endings? I'll give you kick her out.
Even at this point, a national bank was established, a national legal system with juries was set up, a sort of national curriculum was founded to guarantee education for kids from better-off families, and he was trying, really, to create a new upper class based on wealth rather than birthright, with all the privileges that wealthy people enjoy in modern states. For Napoleon, though, his sex life was one thing that carried on just the same after his coronation. He started seeing one of Josephine's ladies-in-waiting, and then a 20-year-old who Josephine had discovered on top of him one afternoon. And in his diary, he wrote,
"Josephine is afraid I may fall in love. She doesn't realise that love was not made for me."
But he was feeling invincible. His whole family was used to build his power base. He wrote to his cousin Eugene,
"I have arranged a marriage for you with Princess Augusta, daughter of the Elector of Bavaria. She is very pretty. I am sending you a portrait of her on a cup."
Then came Napoleon's greatest victory, annihilating the Russians and the Austrians at Austerlitz, following which he wrote a letter to Josephine.
"Yesterday I defeated the Russians and Austrians. I'm a bit tired."
Then Napoleon plans to invade England. He sent his navy to the island of Martinique, where you feel he must have known the terrain a bit. He thought the British navy would chase him there, which would then clear the way for the French navy to nip back and head up the unguarded Thames. But the channel was never left unguarded, and the French therefore could whiz around the world at top speed, sprint across the channel, but never get past Kent, a tradition we've proudly upheld with the Eurostar. So instead he invaded Italy again, so the Pope excommunicated him, and in response, Napoleon had the Pope arrested. I'm not saying that I agree with the concept of emperor, but if you are one, you might as well do stuff like arrest the Pope. And he did a deal with Poland that he would support their independence from Russia if they gave him 40,000 soldiers. So on a visit to Poland, his carriage was surrounded by supporters, including an 18-year-old called Marie Louise. He arranged to meet her, and she turned out to be a countess married to a 77-year-old Polish nationalist with whom she'd had a child. Napoleon told the nationalists that he wouldn't attend their ball that night unless Marie Louise was there and agreed to dance with him. And so the nationalists had to try and persuade the old bloke to let his wife go and dance with Napoleon. What a nightmare that must have been. "He wants to dance with your wife! With your wife! No, he does! No, Napoleon! Napoleon! You do know him! You do! With the hat and the hand inside, you do know him!" So Napoleon took Marie Louise back to France, where he dressed in disguise so that he could take her out to the countryside. And then he insisted to the Poles that to cement the treaty that he'd signed with them, he should marry her. The trouble was that the only person who could annul his marriage to Josephine was the Pope. And he'd arrested him. So Napoleon got a cardinal to announce that his marriage to Josephine didn't count, as he hadn't really wanted to get married to her in the first place. Now, there was still a big section of French society that loved him, especially those that had bought the land, set up the businesses and made money in a way that wouldn't have been possible under the aristocracy. But whereas the early stage of the revolution depended on the mass participation of the population, for Napoleon to be effective, he needed the popular movements to die down. But the megalomania wasn't helping him. He rewrote the catechism of the Catholic Church, so children had to recite,
"What do we owe to Napoleon?
We owe to Napoleon the First, our Emperor, love, respect, obedience, loyalty, military service for the defence of the Empire and its throne."
"Are there not particular reasons which should attach us to our Emperor?"
"According to the Apostle Paul, those who do not render themselves worthy of eternal damnation."
Now that's pretty clever, isn't it? To take over Catholicism and make it madder. A feat not equalled until Puff Daddy covered a Sting song and made it worse. But what was Napoleon thinking? I mean, we all get jealous from time to time. He must have been looking in the Bible and gone, "Look at this, Jesus, 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 there's nothing about me." Napoleon knew that his bid for world domination entailed defeating his main rival, Britain, and that he would have to conquer the whole of Europe and then India. And so he outstretched himself, fighting a war in Spain, which he lost to the Duke of Wellington, and then invading Russia. Now, alongside the political reasons, it's been suggested that Napoleon also had personal reasons for making this decision. It was just after his 40th birthday, and apparently he kept muttering...
And 40 is 40.
I suppose he thought...
I want to invade Russia while I'm young enough to enjoy it.
Or maybe he could have waited until he was 50 and gone on a saga invasion. Napoleon said that even his red genie advised him not to go, but he ignored him. Now, that's real megalomania, that, isn't it? To invent an imaginary genie and then tell him to bugger off as well. That's the sort of nutter in a shopping centre that would be worth listening to, one that went...
I have spoken personally to God. I said to him, I'm not taking any notice of you, you're a loony.
And so Russia was invaded. But even when Napoleon was winning, it was close to disaster. Any soldier who injured a limb had to have it amputated to avoid gangrene. And after one battle, the chief surgeon got through 200 limbs in 12 hours. The Russians deserted Moscow, except for a few arsonists who burnt down the city. So as Napoleon's army got sicker, he was forced to retreat before he could find the Russian army. And then on the way back, as his army tried to loot villages for supplies, the people of the countryside captured thousands of his men, and they carried out the most imaginative tortures. A whole village would come out to beat a captured soldier with hoes. And they probably justified it by going,
"All we're doing is exercising our traditional way of life. These soldiers are pests, and if we stop doing it, we could lose up to 4 million jobs in the hoe-making industry."
So, compassionate Russian officers would shoot captured French soldiers rather than let the peasants get to them. And combined with the cold, this practice killed off 20,000 French soldiers in 3 days. The famine was so great that soldiers would often eat their own severed fingers that had fallen off through frostbite. At night, to keep warm, the soldiers would disembowel one of the dead horses and climb inside. I wonder if any of them thought, oh, I don't know, I could make something off it, knock up a couple of shelves, put some pot plants around the legs. The army was decimated and the European powers responded by invading France and demanding that Napoleon should abdicate. And although he refused for several days, eventually he had no choice. The old king's brother became King Louis the 18th and Napoleon was exiled to the island of Elba. There were 12,000 people on Elba, where Napoleon began to grow a vineyard and build a theatre. He reorganised the island's olive, mulberry and chestnut crops. But he became distraught that his wife and son never visited him, and every day pined for Josephine. And then during his exile, Josephine died of pneumonia, her last words being,
"Bonaparte, Elba."
Then his second wife ran off with a count, and Napoleon never saw her again. But he managed to overcome all these setbacks by escaping with a secret army and reinvading France with only 1,000 men. And he was confronted by a detachment of troops who ordered him to surrender. He got off his horse, walked to the opposing troops and said,
"Here I am. Kill your emperor if you wish."
What a moment that must have been. Napoleon in front of his ex-soldiers, their guns poised, and yet no one shot, and then they began to chant, "Vive l'Empereur!" When the news got out, the Duke of Wellington led an army to France, and Napoleon met him at Waterloo, where Napoleon was winning until he was attacked from behind by an army of Prussians, thereby changing the course of history and of the Eurovision Song Contest. Napoleon was led back to Paris in a carriage where he was greeted by cheering mobs that must have looked similar to those who'd begun the revolution 26 years before. But the course of the revolution was summed up by Napoleon's statement to the cheering mobs.
"I could not, I will not be king of the mob."
And he then did the most peculiar thing. He sailed to England and applied for asylum. You've got to say, top marks for front, Napoleon. Surprisingly, the British didn't accept Napoleon's plea for asylum, and so he was sentenced to another exile, this time to the desolate South Atlantic island of St. Helena. And he lived there for 5 years until he died, probably poisoned. The only independent autopsy showed that he had an enlarged liver and high levels of arsenic, and contrary to the rumours, it also showed he had a fairly average-sized knob. Isn't that so English, though? You can imagine it happening again if public opinion stays against war. You can imagine Blair getting up and saying, "Furthermore, this new dossier reveals that Saddam has a tiny cock." Apart from that, Napoleon is now remembered as the most prominent figure of the French Revolution, but the people who made Napoleon possible were the millions who believed that their actions could create a fairer world, who acted with passion. These are the people whose names are never recorded, but who act with passion and can never be completely removed. For example, I was doing a talk about the French Revolution a little while ago to these teenagers, and afterwards this lad went, yeah, but like, what we really need now is like a sort of another revolution, you know, and I think we can all sort of start that, you know, like now, straight away, you know, by smiling. Right, because you smile, you know, and like then they have to like smile back, even if it's like a capitalist and stuff, and it's all just like ripples, you know. And the brilliant thing is, I quite liked it because I thought, well, yeah, at least there's something about we can change the world from our own actions, and there's a sense of being positive and about do. Don't get me wrong, I do think his strategy is flawed. Surely there is a place for passion in a world where the richest 358 people still own the same total amount of wealth as the poorest 2 billion. The worst thing I think about this government is just the soullessness, the passionlessness, and to be honest, there's some of them that I don't think I disagree with them, because I've never really heard them say anything. Like that one Alistair Darling, he's so soulless and bland, you can't hear him, and I've heard him interviewed, and every time, at the end of it, you just find yourself thinking, shall I have a curry tonight? And, oh God, what did he say? And you think, why don't the presenters be honest? And at the end, when he's finished, they should just say, I'm sorry, mate, do you know, I completely drifted off. I was on a train going to Edinburgh, and there were these three blokes sat round the table with me, and they were drivelling on about their fitted kitchens and their poxy trips to the local garden centre, and then one of them said, oh, I'm very pleased there with my Renault, because, you know, it's getting 35.9 to the gallon on the open road. And I thought, no, that's it, just give up life, there is no point in living once you know to the decimal point how much your poxy, dirty little car is getting on the filthy, poxy open road. Just write a letter to any decent judge and say, dear judge, please allow my pointless existence to end. Any liberal, decent person would allow you to end it now, surely. Is anybody ever going to end up on their deathbed going, oh, it's been a long, hard struggle, but it was worth it, because back in 2002 I was getting 35.9 on the open road. All I can advise people is to at least have a bit of passion, because when you think about it, if the 2 billion got together and stood opposite the 358 smiling, it would look pretty spooky.
The Mark Steele Lecture was written and performed by Mark Steele with the help of Martin Heider and Debbie Isaac. The producer was Lucy Armitage.